Our family has grown. Welcome to the world, Hanna baby. Introducing a new collection, Hanna Soft, made with Tencel. It's so breathable, with stretchy comfort for all of baby's first moments. And it's cool and gentle on their skin all year round. Entrusted Hanna quality for your most precious gift. Hanna Soft, made to last. Shop now at hannaanderson.com. Our family has grown. Welcome to the world, Hanna baby. Introducing a new collection, Hanna Soft, made with Tencel. It's so breathable, with stretchy comfort for all of baby's first moments. And it's cool and gentle on their skin all year round. Entrusted Hanna quality for your most precious gift. Hanna Soft, made to last. Shop now at hannaanderson.com.
What is going on, No Bad Dog Army? Tom Davis here. Thank you, as always, so much for joining me. I really do appreciate it. Today, we have a very special episode for you guys with something that you guys are just living through my selfish wanting to know more information about dogs, curiosity. And that's exactly what this particular episode is on. I had a podcast, if you guys can remember, a couple episodes back, not too long ago, a lady was telling just, and maybe I didn't put it up, I can't remember, but she asked me about rattlesnake training, and I was like, you know what, I don't really know a lot about it, but then it just made me start thinking, like, man, that's probably really cool. I mean, you get rattlesnakes, you get dogs, you get a lot of remote collar usage, you get a lot of helping dogs stay alive. Everything that I love about what I do, about helping dogs and their owners live a healthy, happy life in a different form. And so I just Googled rattlesnake training, and this particular company, Rattlesnake Ready, and Cody and his wife, Kate, have been all over. And so that's who I was like, you know what, this is a young guy. He seems cool. I'm going to contact them. Not that there was nobody else out there doing it. There's lots of people doing it, but I just like the way that this company was put together online. And so we reached out to them and they hopped on. And so this is what that is. And I'm really excited to put it out to you guys, because it just goes over the importance of, you know, the balance of how you can work with dogs and the different things that you can do. And more importantly, the different types of style of training using different tools that you can use to save a dog's life. And that's what this is about. And I hope that you guys enjoy this, because I know that I did. Cody's a great dude, and I really enjoyed talking to him. I mean, it was like cool to, again, we don't get a ton of guests. We get a lot of requests to be on the podcast. And I just, you know, I want to talk to people that, I mean, to be honest with you guys, and I don't want to sound a certain way, a lot of people who approach me to get on the podcast, which is pretty regularly, it just seems like, you know, they just want to promote their, I mean, and this is the business, right? Like, I understand they want to promote their new book or, you know, whatever. And I just want people on the podcast that's going to benefit my audience. Like, I'm not trying to, I mean, unless it's somebody, you know, if this guy put out a rattlesnake book, I mean, I've just had people on the podcast that are promoting stuff and they don't take it that seriously. And it's just, it's not that fun, to be honest. I mean, it's just my experience. And so I get people on the podcast, or I have guests in the podcast that I really want to talk to, that I think is going to add value to your guys' lives. That's why almost every other episode is just me talking to dog owners and helping them through things, because I know that that's going to hit home with somebody. So this is just a nerding out fun podcast. You guys can get a little bit more information about how rattlesnake aversion training works and e-collar work, and it's fun. So hope you guys enjoy the podcast. Make sure you listen to the end, because I'm going to be answering three of your dog training questions. If you want me to answer your specific questions, all you have to do is head over to the iTunes review chart and leave your review and your question in the review. Don't forget, we're going on tour. Yay, we're leaving this weekend. We're going to Nashville to load in to go across the United States to tour. And don't forget, there's still audit spots available. Link in the description below. Every single location that we go to across this United States tour, we're doing a meet and greet between 5:30 and 6:30 at the exact venue that we are training at. So I will be at these venues. Even if you don't have time, you don't have money during the day to come out and audit and watch, you guys can come and meet me, buy some merchandise, talk dogs, and I just want to meet the No Bad Dog Army. That's why we're doing it. It's going to be so fun. Link in the description below. I'll talk to you at the end of the podcast.
My name is Cody Will. Last name's Will. A lot of people call me that too. But we live in Cave Creek, Arizona, which is kind of a suburb of Phoenix. I run a business called Rattlesnake Ready LLC. And essentially, we're a full-time dog training business that completely specializes in rattlesnake aversion training for dogs. And so, just real quick, it's basically from the reality that dogs get bit by rattlesnakes a lot in parts of the Southwest. And we combat that by teaching dogs to keep their noses out of them.
It makes sense. That's important. Yep. Do you have a statistic on... Because I know rattlesnakes are big, obviously, in Arizona, parts of California, and other places. Is yeah. there like a stat that you would that you have about how many dogs get bit per year?
I've heard all kinds of numbers. I don't know what's true and accurate, but it's in the I imagine nationwide, it's in the thousands. Here in Arizona alone, I mean, there's some vets that can get several rattlesnake bites in a single day. It's, you know, some emergency vets just down the road from us, and so. I don't have an actual number, but it's up there. It's more so than humans because, you know, we generally aren't putting our noses in bushes and holes and stuff. So, I would guess it's somewhere in Arizona alone in the several hundreds, if not thousands in a year.
Yeah. And it's, in somebody who doesn't live in that area at all, I live in upstate New York and, yeah. I kind of have my whole adult life. So, obviously, the stuff that we see in the movies and shit like that, like, so it's obviously deadly. So for a dog, because they're smaller than humans for the most part, like, how does that work? Your dog, you're out for a hike with your dog, you know, and all of a sudden they get nailed. Like, what happens usually?
Yeah, I mean, it's very serious. There's a lot of variables. You know, the health and size of the dog plays a role in how serious the bite is. The bite itself, like what kind of rattlesnake it was, how much venom was injected, where the dog was bitten, and all that plays a role. But generally speaking, I mean, at minimum, there's a lot of pain, a lot of swelling. If you look at pictures online, you'll see, and usually when the dog gets bit, it's typically somewhere in the face area, like muzzle or, mouth area like that. Sometimes it's in other spots, but it's usually in the face. And they swell up really bad. General rule is get them to the emergency vet as soon as possible. Typically, they'll administer anti-venom among, other supportive treatment. And the vet bill can run in excess of a couple $1,000s easily. And then there's always the chance that the dog could die from it, too. So it's definitely a serious ordeal. I'd say smaller dogs are way more at risk of dying from it. Bigger, like medium to large breed dogs that are on the, healthy, not super young puppies, but not super old either. They should get through it, statistically speaking. Even whether they survive or not, it's a really painful experience for them. Again, just looking at the photos, you can dig up online. We have a couple on our website as well. It's a lot of pain and not fun. So,
yeah, I have seen that one picture that kind of went viral of the, it looked like a yellow lab or like a cream lab with the face that was like, and a lot of people were like saying it, like he saved his owner or something like that. Something happened. I don't know.
Yeah. I didn't see that exact post, but I see a lot of stuff go around like that. And not to be the Debbie Downer on, whether the dog was saving the owner or not. What we see is when dogs encounter a rattlesnake, they're curious. So they're not necessarily running in to save the day and save the owner. They're running in to see what the thing is that they just found. There was one that actually locally, we had a similar story where this like 6-month-old golden retriever puppy, dove in front of a snake to save its mom. But I mean, how would it know to do that having never run into one before? And so again, typically, cause when we do our training, they want to run right up to the rattlesnake to see what it is, whether the owner's there or not. And, which is an unfortunate problem because they typically, as I was saying earlier, get bit somewhere in the face. And then it's a pretty chaotic day from then onward.
Yeah, and that's how the news works. They want to dramatize the 6-month-old puppy saved dog owner's life in the desert. That's how that goes. Yeah, it sounds great.
Maybe there's an that, yeah, maybe there's one case where that could be kind of true. I don't really know, but I don't, like I said, don't want to be a Debbie Downer, but I see it all the time, and it's usually because they want to see what the little buzzing rope thing is.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I use, and again, like kind of introducing myself to you is, we use all sorts of different types of remote collars for all sorts of different types of training. Obviously, mm-hmm. we do it for behavioral aversion training, and we do it for, you know, bridging things and marking, and we use it for all sorts of different things to capture things. Yeah. It's a lot of fun. And one thing that I, you know, that's why I had reached out to you, and that's why we're meeting right now, is like, I try to get as much knowledge as I can about the tools that we're using and continuing to grow about how other people are doing it. So I'm super interested yeah. in how you guys kind of, and I know, you know, it's like somebody asking me, like, how do you train a dog to stop trying to bite somebody? I know you probably have to say this all the time, but so I apologize, but I'd really like to know how, and you don't have to go into too much detail, but how do you guys, and I was looking on your website that I think it says anywhere from like 6 months on that you can start the training. So how do you guys typically start the aversion training for the rattlesnakes typically?
Yeah, you want to hear more about the process?
I'd like to know like the steps. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, so and that's laid out pretty transparently on the website. We make try to make it so people, when they do go to it, you know, they know exactly what to expect. And but basically, it's four steps typically for new dogs, which are dogs that have never been through any rattlesnake avoidance training. So. They're fitted with an e-collar, and we have a desert landscape training area at our facility. We also do in-home lessons, so we'll go to people's backyards to do the training. And we have live rattlesnakes that we use. They're muzzled, so they can't bite. So we use like a medical tape muzzle that's humane for the snakes, but they're, you know, rendered harmless. And so we start with a small snake first that we put out in a spot that's relatively easy to see, so the dogs get a good first clear, you know, look at it. And essentially, we'll let the dog encounter the snake just like they would in their own backyard or in our desert landscaped area, like on a hike. And as I kind of already alluded to, most dogs are happy to run up right up and investigate what it is. And so essentially, we're using the e-collar as a substitute for the snake bite that would occur if this wasn't a controlled scenario. And so typically, they're infatuated with the snake because it's something new. They want to run up and see what it smells like. And just as they do that and get too close, that's when we give them a correction with the collar. And because of the proximity to the snake and how interested in it they were, they usually blame the snake for where that correction came from and then pretty quickly back off. If they, you know, doesn't phase them and they go back for more, we do it again. And they kind of catch on to the pattern of, okay, you know, I'm getting corrected when I'm too close to the snake. For dogs that have had e-collar experience, you know, they just assume the correction, you know, maybe it did have something to do with the collar, but they still learn it just fine. A lot of dogs we work with have never had an e-collar on before, and they're literally fooled into thinking the snake was the source of it. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it works very efficient and effectively. And as little as just one or two, you know, carefully timed and executed corrections with that first snake. We don't expect them to learn the whole lesson from that, but they can because they got close to a real rattlesnake. But then we supplement that with two additional steps using a speaker and a shed skin from a rattlesnake. The shed skin is simply an item that smells like rattlesnake, but doesn't necessarily look like it. It's not alive. It doesn't rattle. We let them sniff that out, usually approach it from downwind. And as the dogs show interest in that as well, we'll reinforce that's a bad odor, even if you don't see the snake present. And then in a lot of cases, if the dog got a good whiff of the real snake in that first step, they already know to avoid the skin. So we see that a lot too. Followed by that is the speaker step. There's a speaker hidden in some bushes that we play a nice, loud, realistic recording of a rattlesnake. And essentially, we teach them to run from rattling. We play a loud recording. I usually have the owner be involved in this step too. They'll yell a command, like leave it or something. They themselves run away from the sound too, and that kind of helps sell it better. That's the only step we do that on. We don't do that on the other steps because with this training, we don't want a whole lot of owner involvement because we're teaching the dog to avoid the snake for their own good. And so they're not needing to hear commands like leave it or no or whatever to know to leave the snake alone. We want them to choose on their own to leave the snake alone. And so anyway, followed by the sound part, the last thing we do is bring out an adult rattlesnake, you know, whereas the first one was on the smaller side. That's just kind of so the dogs got to see a couple different sizes. Usually by that point, they want absolutely nothing to do with it, though. So if we can't get them near it and they're willingly avoiding it, then they're good to go. And that's essentially it.
Cool. Do you do like follow-ups? You know, if you did that with like a six-month-old puppy, yeah, they would probably learn quick, I would assume. But do you do like follow-ups over time? Or
yes. Yeah, so we recommend, yeah, that varies a little bit per dog too. Generally speaking, this is kind of one of the few dog trainings that you can really get it done in one shot. Like as long as the first round like went smooth, the dog clearly understood the message, like they get it down really well. We do want people to test to make sure that's true though. And so that's what we encourage follow-up visits for, which those are a half price version where the better word is actually pop quiz. So a follow-up is right. More of a put the snake out, see what the dog remembers. And this can be anywhere from, you know, 6 months to a year later. We get people that just are adamant about making sure that the dog remembers. So they'll bring them back on the earlier side. But if the dog did really well, I usually tell people, honestly, a year later is a good, good amount of time to test the long-term effectiveness of it, but also not like too much time that hopefully they didn't forget. And so, and I would say that the reason we're not pushy with follow-ups is, I mean, over 9 out of 10 times, the dog remembers the snake really well and wants nothing to do with it the second time they see it. And that's kind of how we know that it works well the first time. You know, occasionally we get a knucklehead or two that needs a good reminder, but which is to be expected. And you brought up like a 6-month-old puppy. Usually dogs that are under a year when they first go through it, we strongly push follow-ups on those. Seems like once they've hit a year and older, the retention gets even better. But under a year, 6 months to a year, they're old enough for the training, but the retention is still really high. But we've noticed some of those younger ones need a little reinforcement about 6 months later, and then that's pretty good after that.
Cool.
Yeah.
So I had I'd talked to one of my trainers earlier at my facility, and I just told her, I said, hey, I'm doing this rattlesnake prevention training podcast with this guy, and I'm super excited. And she was saying that, and I wanted to like run this by you to see if you've done this before, if you've heard of this. She was saying that she was watching this one training video where they would condition the dog to essentially recall when the rattlesnake odor was found. So basically same thing that you're doing is that the rattlesnake would come out or the scent would come out and then the dog would recall and the dog would get paid, which I get. And I was like, okay. Yep. And what the benefit of having the dog conditioned to respond to a recall when they smelt the rattle or saw the rattle, smelt first, I would assume. And then is to also alarm and alert the owner that there's a rattlesnake in the area.
Yeah, and so that is kind of sometimes just like a natural side effect of the training. So I don't actually specifically train the dog to recall like straight to the owner. I mean, a lot of them just kind of naturally do because after they have their scare with the snake, they run right to the owner. And I always tell people, right, you can pet your dog, praise them at any point during this training. They're not doing anything wrong. They're just learning that rattlesnakes aren't fun to be close to, but they're not being a bad dog or anything. So we don't necessarily like specifically teach them to run to the owner. Really what my ultimate goal is to keep them out of the emergency vet. And so simply we're teaching them to leave the snake alone and back off. And so some dogs will run right back to the owner. That's just how they are. Others, you know, will just leave the snake alone and get on with their day and go elsewhere to explore. So to me, it's the key thing is making sure they know to leave the snake alone. You know, some bark at the snake and stay back several feet. We usually encourage that behavior when it pops up because I tell the owner that's one thing you do want them barking at if they find one, you know. So there's ways that, and that's also why too, we let owners be involved in the training is whatever kind of organic behavior pops up as a result of the training, the owner got to see how it went down, mm-hmm. and in the future kind of know what to look for, because we've had dogs that on trails just put the brakes on and don't want to go any further, and sure enough it's because they caught wind of one and they just froze right there, which is great. And then you get some that bark at them. So I'm not necessarily trying to draw out any specific behavior. We could probably do that. It would take a little more, you know, time and effort, because we would try and build that and do more repetition and stuff like that. But my goal is to get them in and out fairly quickly, not for the sake of just blowing through it, but because it's kind of a scary lesson, we're spooking them to avoid rattlesnakes. We don't want to draw it out longer than necessary. Yep. And so my goal is to make them more or less afraid / respect them and, you know, give them space. Yeah. And we do get some that just automatically return to their owner, but I wouldn't say it's something I specifically teach them to do. But not to say that couldn't be done. I mean, every owner ideally wants their dog to react in a way that they can read really easily. And that's how they know there's a snake there. But usually you can see that from going through the training, the way we do it now.
Yeah. It's just amazing. You know, as you're talking through how you guys do things, it's amazing to just think about all the other things like in the dog world that is pretty much the same foundation, rather it's, mm-hmm. you know, bomb detection, drug detection, cadaver detection, search and rescue. It's all a conditioning response thing. And it's pretty like, as you're, that's why I wanted to have you on, is cause it gets the brain going where, so you could essentially, what you're doing is you're obviously teaching the dog through an aversive of the dog gets close to this thing and then they get a correction. And then there's a lot of other ways outside of that. Like if you were doing detection to, teach the dog to like alert that there's something there, they would do a different behavior. They may sit or they may point naturally, like hunting dogs would. Have you had those like really squirrely, like GSPs or any of those like really squirrely field beagles that are like just like loving this thing?
It's fun because we do a high volume of dogs, so I just get to see different dogs, different breeds every day, and all kinds of different responses. And sometimes it's more of a personality thing than a breed thing in terms of how they do with it.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, they're all different. And you just brought up pointers. I've had several pointers that point the rattlesnake after they've found it. And, you know, for the non-hunting crowd, they think that's cool. And then the hunting crowd is like, well, shoot, now if I go flush a bush to try and get a quail out, is there going to be a rattlesnake there?
Yeah.
So, all kinds of different behaviors come out. And that's where, as you were saying, like with all detection type dogs, you know, they've been trained to not only respond to a cue, but respond a certain way to that cue. I'm not as picky, like they don't need to respond in a specific way other than simply back off from these things because they're dangerous. And so, like I said, I've had dogs point them, I've had dogs bark at them, and I've had dogs that simply shy away from them and get on with their day. And so the end goal, though, is all of those dogs know not to approach it, and that's what's going to keep them from getting hurt. I would say, like, in a way, I'm not really creating rattlesnake detection dogs.
Right.
Kind of am, but also it's more teaching dogs the same things we know, which is, hey, don't mess with a rattlesnake. And that's what's gonna, because most of the time when a dog gets bit, it was probably a preventable one, meaning they encounter it, the snake did not want to bite the dog, but, you know, as the dog gets right up in the snake's face, the snake interprets that dog as a predator and it has to defend itself. And so that's where, you know, bites to the face typically occur. And had that dog known that this thing was a threat, it should have, you know, backed off, sort of thing. Yeah, you know, there's occasional bites where a dog steps on one, didn't see it, or just like with people, you know, that can happen as well. But generally speaking, a lot of bites are they're just innocently curious, and so we're essentially teaching them to not do that and keep them out of trouble that way.
Yeah, no, that's great. I love it. And what e-collars do you guys usually use? Like what type?
When I started the business, I did a lot of research and I landed on the Dogtra e-collars, and that's what I've used ever since. And I know there's a lot of great ones out there. I know a lot of trainers that use like e-collar technologies, and I know the Garmin ones have taken off. And I started with Dogtra and they've been great, reliable collars, and I've been using them ever since. So we run the 1900s for like the bigger dogs, and then we have their IQ model for the smaller dogs. I'm actually about due to get a whole new round of new collars, so I'm going to get a couple of their other models too. They just came out with a micro size pretty recently, which we do get little tiny. I just did a 2.7 pound Yorkie Maltese mix the other day, and it would have been handy to have that micro collar for that one.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. And for those of you who are listening, Cody and I didn't know each other before this, and Cody didn't know anything about me, but I have my own signature series collar with Dogtra. So it's funny that you, so it's funny that you said Dogtra, because like you could have said anything and I wouldn't have cared regardless. But that's the same thing with me, is I grew up on the old Dogtra NCPs, just doing recall and stuff. And so we actually came out with like a Tom Davis series. It's Dogtra's first e-collar that they have a boost on. So we included a boost on it, and it's like a cool colored collar too. So anyway,
you know what? It's funny you say that, the small world, because I was just on there the other day looking at, they're out of stock of the I think the 282C, which I want for smaller dogs as well. And I was looking through, and I remember seeing that collar. So cool, I get to meet the face now.
That's me. Yeah. Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
So
nice. Yeah, they're great.
Yeah, I agree. So when you're, and you know, everybody from dog owners to professionals listen to the podcast, and so some people will know some of the lingo and numbers and stuff. So when you're using like a 1900S, like a higher output collar, and what, just so I know and people who are listening knows, like what numbers are you usually starting on for that version?
Yeah, that's a good question. And we get asked that a lot here too. Like, but you know, it's funny because when customers ask us that question, they don't know the scaling Dogtra uses, you know, compared to their own collars, if it's a different brand. And to be completely honest, a lot of times I don't even necessarily look right at the remote. Like I'm watching the dog and their reaction. And so typically when they're infatuated with the snake and run up to it, we always start low in case it is a super sensitive dog. Low meaning, I mean, I can have it set at 20, 30, somewhere in there. And I've had dogs that jump and run away from the snake at a level as low as that. And then I've had other dogs that don't even feel that, you know, range. And so typically as they get close to the snake, I'm actually nicking away at light levels as I'm gradually increasing until I see the reaction that I want, which is typically jump and back off from the snake. And so I would say most dogs respond between, on average, probably between 40 and 60, and that collar goes 0 to 127, and usually a 40 to 60 will stop them and get them to jump back, and that doesn't mean, you know, screaming backflip, but it isn't like a lynch either. Like, it usually is just enough to get their attention and spook them, and this is where, if they don't go near the snake again, I'll leave it right there. If they kind of jump and then they go right back for more, the next one's going to be a little higher. And we kind of stair step up from there until they're totally done with it.
Mm-hmm.
I've had dogs that need it all the way up. I've had dogs need it all the way up and on constant. It was the only way to get them off the snake. And so, again, they're all different. We see reactions across the board.
Sure.
I don't know if you agree with this or not, but it seems like coat type can kind of affect what they feel and how they feel it and all that. And so, I've used that full range of levels on their collars. And it's different for every dog, but like I said, between 40 and 60 is probably average for most that have never felt it before. Usually dogs that have had some e-collar work before, if I just go a tad higher than they're used to, that usually does the trick. Yeah, it's kind of, like I said, I'm mostly looking at their reaction rather than, you know, numbers.
Yeah.
So
now when you say you're nicking, so let's say you know where the snake is when the dog's out, right?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, okay. So the dog's going towards the snake and then you're just nicking like tap or
I mean, I usually hold out till they're right up on the snake, and this is where, honestly, just because of how long I've done it, it's hard to explain, but you know, when you've used the same collars for years and you know the settings and everything well, like you can be, it's like a video game. You can be pretty quick. And so generally speaking, like the minute they're right at the perfect spot. So, and every dog's different. Some approach it very slowly. They're like tiptoeing, like, what is this thing? And they're being cautious about it. That one probably needs a lower level. Whereas if the dog is like full, run right at the snake, I'm going to have to hit them a little harder and a little further back to protect the snake, basically. But generally, as soon as they notice it, and you have dogs different too, some will see it and go up to it. Others, they're pretty camouflaged. So a lot of dogs don't see it until they're right next to it. And all of a sudden, if it rattles and they look down right at it, that's the perfect moment to correct them because it was paired with the surprise of the snake.
Got it.
And so, yeah, that's where I'll kind of might jump to a level that I feel, you know, should work for that dog. And yeah, I usually can nail it the first one or two corrections, like right off the bat. And like I said, I've also done it too where I feel like I hit them at the right time, but I could tell it wasn't quite enough to fully get their attention. So then I'll very quickly jump the level and hit and do a second nick, basically two back to back. And it's because I could tell that first one didn't quite get their attention good enough. I didn't want to miss this first opportunity to really, you know, convince them. And so again, it's hard to explain, but it's, yeah, I have to be pretty quick on the fingers because this whole training and the skill behind it is completely wrapped up in getting the timing perfect and, you know, when and where to correct, because if you do it too late, too early, not enough, much, that can all impact the way the rest of the training goes and if the dog really fully understands or not. So that's something that, yeah, I feel like I've kind of developed over the years a pretty good skill, at least with this specific training.
Yeah. And I think it doesn't matter if it's obedience or as serious as what you're doing. I think almost all the training that you're doing with dogs is life or death. I mean, but with what you're doing, it really is obviously amplified quite a bit because you're dealing with a natural, I don't know if you want to call it a predator, but I mean, it's something that can kill your dog if you're not paying attention. And so, you know, one thing that I always try to explain to the public and try to explain to my clients and try to explain to just dog people who are hungry for information. So in the Arizona world, like you're probably so busy with doing your remote collar training because so many people love their dogs and they do not, and they enjoy outside. And I think living in that area, like it's inevitable. Like even I've had some clients that live in like the Scottsdale area. And it's like, it doesn't matter if you're downtown in a really nice area. It's still like the whole place is dry and like there's the red rocks. And it like to somebody who doesn't live there, the whole place looks like Arizona, you know, unless you're like probably downtown Phoenix, like the whole place is, you know, there's cactus and there's palm trees and there's just like red rocks everywhere. It looks like a big desert. So I'm sure I would assume you're extremely busy. What is the, is there any, and I'm just, this is just a selfish question for me, but is there pushback from people in your community about just aversion training in general? Because I know across the board, all across the world, actually, there's this educational missing piece from a lot of like what remote collars and e-collars can do and the benefits of them and how life-saving they can be in a behavioral, you know, case of training, a basic recall training. And of course, in your case, it's like for what, if I did like a session with a 6-month-old dog on recall, cause their owners wanted to go hiking all the time, you know, somebody could argue, well, they'll never run away. And it's like, okay. But like where you live, it's like, if you're going to go outside with your dog, there's a good chance at some point that dog, or do you want to flip that coin? So my question is do you have pushback in Arizona from others, rather there are other trainers or just dog lovers who don't understand it? I'm just curious to see like what the community like is like that.
Just toward the training or the e-collars in general?
Just in general, like, I mean, you're literally like teaching dogs not to get bit by rattlesnakes. Like how does that...
So luckily most of our clientele, by the time they call us to schedule, they've already, you know, I feel like anymore, a lot of people do a lot of research on things, especially for their dogs before they make a run with it. Mm. And so I would say we don't get a lot of pushback, and it's because I think they already kind of did research and they feel comfortable with the process. Now that doesn't mean we don't get any, we do get, we get a handful of people pretty regularly that are in that boat of, okay, a quick correction is way better than getting, you know, bit by a rattlesnake. Like I get that, but they don't want to scare their dog, you know? And so that's where, you know, sometimes I catch myself like, and that's the thing too. I don't want to sell this. I want people to want it. Like, I don't want to convince somebody they need this. It's like, if I had a dog and I lived in Arizona, which ironically, you know, I play with other people's dogs all day long. We don't have our own, but, so I say that, you know, if I had my own and I live anywhere near desert, it's worth doing the training because they are at risk of encountering one and getting hurt. And so, yeah, we get, how should I say it? Not skeptical, but just like concerned people that they're already convinced they want to do it. And I'm usually pretty thorough about part of the process when people come here is they fill out paperwork, we take the payment, and then I just literally walk them through the whole process in detail and just to make them as comfortable as possible, knowing exactly what to expect. And it's actually kind of fun. I almost find it, it's a good challenge to, we get these people that come in that are really concerned. By the end of the training, they loved it. They're like, oh, that wasn't so bad. Wow, mm-hmm. I'm so proud of my dog. It responded so well. That was great. So I actually almost kind of welcome some of those types that are concerned because it's been fun to watch them become believers in the training and really end up promoting it instead of being, you know, concerned. And I think some of that concern comes from there are other people that do this as well and probably are way too harsh with the correcting and things like that. And, you know, you see these videos on YouTube or places, and sometimes that can create a bad rap for the training. And that's where you get some people that come to us and think that we're just going to abuse their dogs. And the reality is, no, like we're going to spook them just enough to make them respect and know to avoid rattlesnakes. And that's it. I'd say there's some, and I think the ones that are very like anti-collar in general, they just never call us to begin with, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I just wasn't sure if you, you know, like a lot of, you know, there's a lot of politics in the dog world and my objective is to not argue with anybody or any of those people. My objective is to say, hey, if you're a dog owner and you're having problems with your dog, don't put all your eggs in one basket and say that there's only one way to train this dog because, of course, you know, we see this a lot with dog owners who come in that their last dog or their past dog or their family dog had never needed training. And then they have a dog with serious issues and then they end up. Mm-hmm. So I just tell people to, you know, usually the research and the proof is in the pudding, but unfortunately the internet is a blessing and a curse. There's a lot of people out there that, you know, also are just idiots. And it makes people who use like the same equipment, but in much different ways, maybe throw, shade on what you do and what I do and other people do. And so I was just curious, you know, like just with all the politics in the dog world and how that works. I was just curious. Yeah. So when you're doing this avoidance, so you could essentially do this with anything that has a scent. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, anything that the dog's just, I mean, almost anything new, you know, most dogs are happy to investigate. So, I mean, theoretically you could do it with almost anything. We actually used to do, so Arizona, it's a amazing, beautiful place, but there's a bunch of fun stuff out here. We also get poisonous toads out here that dogs get in trouble with as well. And so we used to offer aversion training for those too. We're so busy with rattlesnake training. Long story short, I just recently made the judgment call to pass that off to somebody else and just keep focusing on the snake part. So we actually have a friend of mine that does toad avoidance training out here in the Phoenix area as well. So theoretically for lots of other things, this same system could work if, you know, done carefully.
Yeah, because you're basically. My head keeps going back to, like hunting dogs or people who use dogs for, you know, coon training or mountain lion or rabbit training or any type of like game train or birds or whatever. I mean, whatever's popular or whatever. It's just like it's similar as you're teaching the and a lot of these breeds have instinctual desires to do some of the things that they want to do anyway. It's just, you're just flipping it around where you're just doing the opposite. We're discouraging, you know, we're discouraging the dog from going to this smell. Have you worked with dogs who have been deaf and you've only been using it for, because you said the sound box and stuff, you've just done the scent, right?
Yeah, so I've worked with blind dogs, I've worked with deaf dogs. You know, we get some older dogs too that are a little bit of both. And so luckily the training, every dog can learn it to the best of their own ability, whatever that is. And with certain handicaps, like, I mean, because it hits on other senses too. So for instance, a deaf dog we just skip that recording step, but they're still getting to see the live rattlesnakes and learn to avoid them. They're still getting to pick up on the odor through the real snakes themselves, plus the scent step that we do. So yeah, because it hits on all senses, you know, for dogs that, you know, are blind, we can same thing, focus on scent, but also sound, and whatever's working, we can teach them to avoid that.
Have you, have you ever been bit by a rattlesnake in your teachings? And
I have been bit by a rattlesnake before, about 3 years ago and 10 years of doing this. It wasn't related to the training though. It was, we actually have a 2,400 square foot like nature center. We have a zoo license. We have a bunch of rattlesnakes on display. We try to educate the public on rattlesnakes too. And so that's why we more or less built that. One of the snakes in the collection had a medical condition that I was addressing, and long story short, I didn't have it restrained properly, which one of those things where, you know, you do something a million times, you can get complacent over time. And I knew I cut a corner when it came to being safe, and that's all it took. And it got me in the right index finger and spent 2 days in ICU. And it was not a fun ride, but I took it as a learning experience and got more careful and moved on. But during the training itself, you know, that's the snakes are muzzled and they're again rendered harmless. So yeah, my only accident was screwing up on one of the other snakes in our collection that we don't even use for the training.
When you're using, are there certain, and this is again just a selfish question for me, and I want to know, is do snakes have different behaviors? Like, I'm sure they do, right?
Yeah. I think the word I use when I'm describing the different snakes, they just have different temperament, you know. You could say personalities, whatever word you want to use, but the reality is, you know, you can put three diamondbacks side by side, and there's some predictable behaviors you'll see, but then you get some that are more relaxed and calm than others, and you get some that are way more defensive than others. And we kind of have a collection now of snakes that are basically right in the middle. So they are not so high strung that they're hard to, you know, keep happy in captivity, but not so mellow that they're also kind of useless, you know, for the training. So we've kind of got a collection that I've fine tuned over the years that are just the right temperament, where they will put on a show and rattle and act like a rattlesnake, but they're pretty reluctant to strike and are easy for me to work with and do great in captivity. So yes, they do. And I'm grateful for that, because I can, you know, get what I need, and they're not just all impossible to work with.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I can, I mean, that's like a double whammy for you, is you get to work with dogs, but then you get to hang out with some rattlesnakes. So you have them at your house, or is the nature place off your personal property? Or
yeah, I don't know if you can see.
Oh yeah,
I can behind see me here on FaceTime. But yeah. So we've got the property is a combination of our business and our residence. So the house is on one side of the property, and then the zoo and training facility is on the other side. And so our nature center is where all of the training rattlesnakes are held. And then we have a bunch of other more exotic stuff that we have on display that we don't use for the training. But yeah, they're all in the, you know, part of that too is we try to communicate. Like, I actually do this because, you know, I love animals, grew up with dogs and love them, but I also love reptiles too. And this business began out of a passion for both. And so we have our training snakes that, again, I take great pride in how we care for them, and you can see them on display here. You can see that they're healthy and live in big, healthy, you know, big exhibits where they have all their basic needs met. And they're not in the house. When I first started, that's where they were, but as soon as we could and had this built, they were in their own building. We've got a baby right now, so one of the key things was to get those out of the house to make sure our household was totally safe. And, you know, they're in locking exhibits now.
Yeah. Yeah, I could imagine that would be a top priority as you grew your company, to get those things in a separate living space. And it's, your wife, Kate, right? You guys run the business together?
Yeah.
That's cool.
We do, yeah. She does all the schedule and admin and everything, and I do the actual training and the snake care.
Cool. Yeah, I think that's who we were emailing with, I would assume. How old is your baby?
He's 4 months.
Mine too. What was his birthday?
Nice. July 7th.
Oh, mine was July 8th. My babies.
Holy cow. That's
yeah.
funny.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. His name is, my son's name is Banks.
Okay. Ours is also a B. It's Barrett.
Cool. Yeah. That's funny. That's a small world. Yeah. It's been a fun ride, hasn't it? He's sleeping and trying to sleep. Yep. Is he sleeping through the night?
I was going to say, as a running a small business, and actually she used to work here in the office where I'm sitting right now, and she would greet customers, fill out paperwork, take payment, and I would, you know, have a little downtime in between each dog as she was taking care of that stuff. She's watching him all day, and I'm back and forth doing both. So it's been a little crazy, especially with the lack of sleep. But
yeah,
just about a week ago, he started sleeping through the night. He has a couple nights where he wakes up, but she's been really good about all the sleep training and whatnot. And speaking of training, just a whole different kind of training there. But he's getting through the night most of the time, which I'm really grateful for.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, ours too. He's starting to sleep through the night, and it's been good. I think the first month and change is, you know, it's expected. It's exciting, and you know, when they wake up, you're like, yay, and then it's like, oh man, I'd love some sleep.
Exactly.
That's cool. Well, like I said, man, I really find it fascinating the difference in complexities, but also the same. It's like the same foundation. Like when we're doing, again, any type of scent detection, whether it's search and rescue or cadaver work or any of the stuff where we say, hey, go get it. Good job, get it. And the dog is working and we're using tons of positive reinforcement and we're like encouraging that to happen. Like, yeah, go find it. You're going to get paid heavily. So lots of positive reinforcement, and then we're using essentially positive punishment, but it's a superstitious positive punishment of like, but it's not even right because they know that they think it's the snake. So it's just like rewarding this behavior to find and get this thing. And then it's correcting and balancing out like, hey, this is the exact opposite. Like we want to run away from this.
And I'll interrupt you there to say, I have to remind clients too, like, again, we're not teaching them to, you know, as you're pointing out, like not to find this thing. We're teaching them, hey, if you do find one of these, get away from it. And that's what we praise. And so that's something too. I do try and incorporate, as I said earlier, you know, if the dog avoids the snake, runs to the owner, like I always tell him, like, you know, praise the heck out of him. He did what he was supposed to. He got away from it. And, you know, there's ways we incorporate a little bit of positive reinforcement into it. But so much of it is simply teaching them, hey, you see, smell, or hear one of these things, get right out of there.
Yeah. Yeah. Your life depends on it. And if you, yeah, and that's interesting. And so and now I wanted to say this earlier, but I forgot. So there's not a lot of difference in what you're doing and the very popular like invisible fence system, right? It's some sort of cue. Like it could be a you know, and a lot of the invisible fences, like they start off with a flag, like, hey, get out. It's uncomfortable when you go near there, and it intensifies as you get closer, so don't go there. Because I think a lot of dog owners just assume that dogs understand what their owners, like what property they bought and the plot of their land. And it's like, no, those flags basically mean that if they go near that, they're getting corrected. I mean, it's uncomfortable for them. And it's interesting to see the amount of scalability as that, like that yellow lab, big invisible fence van rolls through suburbs and people are buying it left and right. And really what they're doing is they're doing a lot of what you're doing with avoidance training, just you're doing it more modernized and a little bit more specific to certain things. But isn't that the same type of training where the dogs are avoiding these things without the smell, obviously?
Yeah, I would say in general, it's definitely very similar. It does have some of its differences because, you know, with the training, as you pointed out, like typically you have the flags, and hopefully the goal is over time, you don't even need those flags there anymore. The dog's still avoiding that bound or that line. Mm-hmm. I think with this training, they catch on really quick. And I think it's because with this training, you know, some dogs, I don't know if they immediately connected to the flags, they might have to catch on after a few, even with snake training, sometimes it takes a few times, but with the snake training, there's something very new and exciting and tangible right there. And so, again, they're usually so, you know, curious about it. And then when they get corrected, they're very quick to blame the snake. Mm-hmm. With the kind of in-ground fence stuff, you know, some dogs get it immediately, and then others kind of, you know, they don't exactly know where it came from, sort of thing. They do, you know, they figure it out. But again, I think with ours, because we've had some people that have had their dog go through some other training, and they were really worried that with this, it was going to have like crisscrossing issues, or the dog going to have flashbacks, and because it had, they had a bad experience with another trainer with e-collar use or whatever. And I usually, without pushing them, say, look, like I've had dogs with zero e-collar experience, and I've had some dogs with, you know, moderate amount, and I've had some that probably get, they use it way too much for every random little thing. And they usually get through this training pretty well. And I think it's because they don't overthink it. They show interest in something new, and then boom, something happens. Doesn't matter where it came from. They're like, okay, I'm not going near that again, you know?
Yeah, you're using it very one-dimensional, but in a good way. It's like, don't overthink it. It's not overly complicated. It's if you're close to this thing that smells a certain way, sounds a certain way, looks a certain way, it's bad and you need to get out of there. And so as soon as they, it's the, and again, man, my brain's just going, it's like, it's the same conditioning for dog owners who are listening, that if they hear a chip bag and they've gotten a chip, like they're conditioned to go to that. They're like, this means something for me potentially. Or if you know, their owners are sitting there eating a steak and they've been paid from the table, dogs are so conditioned animals that it can work with you on so many aspects of punishment and aversive training, as well as of course reward and trying to capture new things. Yeah. And it's literally the same thing. It's just dogs understand it's balance, right? It's like good and bad.
They catch on to patterns.
Exactly. And some of those patterns have scent, some of those patterns have sound, some of those patterns have all of that. So anyway, that's why I wanted, that's why I wanted to give you a call and talk to you about this, because I find it, I mean, we get all the time, we get people wanting to get on the podcast to talk about their new book about, you know, like something I've never even heard of. And I'm like, no offense, it's probably a great book, but I just don't know anything about it. And it's like, you know, when I was like, oh, I need to get a snake person on this podcast. So I'm really interested in this stuff because it's got so much to do with the actual hands-on life-saving training. And that's typically what I gravitate towards. So I know you got to get to some. So when you do a tour of the facility, that means people just come and just check the place out?
Exactly. We get some people that want to just kind of see the place and hear more about the dog training. And, you know, those are actually pretty rare. Because of our rattlesnake collection, we actually have one of the bigger rattlesnake collections in the country. We have all different kinds. And so we actually get a lot of like reptile people that want to see all that too. Oh. And so this is more reptile crowd that's coming than the dog training. But 99% of what I do is the dog training. That's what I birthed the whole business out of. That's what is the whole show basically. But having this big nature center too is also been kind of fun to do occasional like field trips and tours like this for people that are fanatics about the whole reptile part. That's what's happening here shortly, but
cool.
Yeah. So I think I'm one of the few people out there that, not to like toot my own horn, this just means I'm a weird breed, but I love both. A lot of people that are into this are a dog person who found some kind of reptile guy that could help them out, and they teamed up. Or you get like a total reptile guy who just doesn't know anything about dogs. And I've pretty much, you know, I wouldn't say I'm a master at it at both, but I love both and passionate about learning about both. And so I've got a lot of knowledge in the dog part and the snake part. And that's what I think makes our business work pretty well. Cause it's literally just myself and my wife, that do everything, and, keeps us plenty busy.
That's amazing. Yeah, man. Well, like I said, I appreciate you coming on. What I'll do is I'll send you out, one of my collars. I want you to check it out because, it has that boost. So, and it has a bungee. So I don't know if you've ever used bungees or not, but it has that boost where you'll be able to jump just instantaneously, like to that higher level. So I'm going to send you one out, and you could check it out.
That's
course.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Team, Team Dogcha. So I'll send it out to you. And then, I'll just link all your website and all your social handles. If you have any, I'll just put them in the description. But is there any like main, social media page that you use on a regular?
Yeah. So, the biggest thing is just the website itself, rattlesnakeready.com, that lays out the whole training process and costs and details and our location and all that fun stuff. We use Facebook and Instagram fairly regularly. Instagram as of recently, I was pretty slow to use that, but, so that's, at Rattlesnake Ready. And then if you just look up Rattlesnake Ready LLC, that'll come up for Facebook. And that's for all the dog training part. The property location, I more or less call Rattlesnake Ranch. And we have a separate Instagram for that. It's just at rattlesnakeranch.az. And that's for the snake part of the business. So it's funny because, we have two different crowds. We have the dog lovers who don't want to see in their news feed constant pictures of rattlesnakes. And then we get our reptile crowd that doesn't need to see a bunch of dogs. So we have kind of two separate ones. And just so I'm not bombarding the dog people with snake stuff, all the snake stuff is on the Rattlesnake Ranch one, and then the dog stuff is on the Rattlesnake Ready one. So the Rattlesnake Ready is specifically the dog training. What the name came from, making sure that dogs are ready for a rattlesnake encounter.
I love it. Training. Yeah. I love it, man. You're saving many dogs' lives, I'm sure, or at least you're definitely saving lots of vet visits and lots of money. That's for sure.
Yeah, we think so.
All right, man. Well, it's a pleasure having you on, and I'll send that stuff out to you, and we'll talk to you soon. Thank you.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you so much.
All right, see you, Cody. Bye. All right, you guys, you've reached the end of the podcast, and I'm going to be answering three of your dog training questions. The first one comes from SCMMAMD. This podcast is a great resource for understanding canine psychology and training. I found the information he shares very helpful while training and working my Czech Shepherd. Thank you so much. All right, and the last question for today is XHBZRY, Behavior Correction Strategies. Hi, Tom, love the podcast, and I've learned so much helpful things raising and training my dog. I have a 6-month-old 40-pound mutt that we adopted at 3 months. She's done great with basic obedience, and we introduced the 280E collar about 3 weeks ago to reinforce her training with the eventual goal of having control of her off-leash. We take her to a dog park close by that's pretty much every day, and she loves it. They're a great group of dogs and dog owners that frequent this place, and she is comfortable and confident there to meet other dogs and people. Here's my question. At the dog park, she will get jealous if I pet another dog but try to stick her head in between us just to get into their face. She's never bitten or escalated further into situation, but I interpret it as a guarding behavior. She does not have any history of resource guarding or aggression. I have dealt with the problem by trying to desensitize it through the time at the park. I get down and pet her and then other dogs at the same time to help, but only lasts until the next time we go to the park. So far, I have not corrected her with the e-collar. She responds between a level 3 and 4, and I can get her attention with moderate distraction at a 10 or 12. My question is when she does this behavior, would it be appropriate use of pager function? It's a great question. I wouldn't personally, just because I wouldn't want to associate the other dog with this. The e-collar, as most of you know, or some of you know, as I talk about in my course, is a very, the pager that we use, the vibrate function that we use, is a very like intervention style of training of like, oh crap, this is dangerous. We should like the snake training that we were just talking about, that type of stuff. I wouldn't give like a harsh, like pager, holy crap type of correction under those circumstances, because it might do the opposite. I would just be working on like your verbal, like, hey, quit the crap, leave it. Even putting like a tab leash on the dog and just popping the dog a little bit. So I just wouldn't, unless it like escalated, but, that's my answer. I would just like leave it. No, or just do the best you can to ignore other dogs, to be honest. Like, I think that's also something that you should do. But I would just verbally, hey, knock it off, inappropriate, nope. Have a tab leash, which is like a 4-inch leash that you put on the dog, you can just grab and pop. Say, nope, we're not doing that. And again, just be careful how you're setting your dog up. So anyway, I hope that helps. I hope you guys enjoyed this podcast. You're actually probably listening to this when we're on the road. I'm recording this now and I'm putting it out next week. So we should be on the road right now. Come out and meet me. Come hang out. I want to meet you guys. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're filming the whole thing. So we want you guys in the vlogs. We want you guys out. We want to see you guys. We want to meet you guys. Link in the description below for all the details. I'll talk to you guys next time. Bye.
Our family has grown. Welcome to the world, Hanna baby. Introducing a new collection, Hanna Soft, made with Tencel. It's so breathable, with stretchy comfort for all of baby's first moments. And it's cool and gentle on their skin all year round. Entrusted Hanna quality for your most precious gift. Hanna Soft, made to last. Shop now at hannaandersson.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.